Hello, I'm Andrew, and welcome to this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News for the 6th of March, 2024.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by the sight loss charity Beacons. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. Once you've enabled the Talking Newspapers skill, all you need to do is play Talking Newspapers and ask for the Black Country Talking News. Our Talking News service is also available via the free Wireless for the Blind app. It can be found on the Beacon Centre website, www.beaconvision.org/talking-news. As a podcast via services such as Apple or Spotify, or as a free CD, simply contact Beacon Centre on 01902 880 111. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Reading for you this week, we have myself, Andrew, Angela, Ian, Christine, Helen, Mina, Simon, and of course, not forgetting, Flashback Roger. In this week's edition, we have the latest Beacon update from Helen, from Milk Floats and their like to the nostalgia of the miners' strike. We have the latest news for the Black Country. We have the quiz with Mina. There's mixed fortune in the football news for West Brom and Wolves. A Did You Know section from Flashback Roger. We hear from Mina, who has all the weather for the weekend. And seeing that we are still in a season of cold, wet weather and early sunsets, we have another book review to enjoy from the cozy comforts of home. Local news to start though with Ian, Christine, but first, Angela.
The cost of living crisis is far from over, and people are being urged to be on their guard against scams promising financial support. A new warning has been issued to householders over offers of cash to help with the sky-high prices of food, energy bills, and other everyday expenses. Many may still be in dire need of financial support, but are being urged not to fall prey to scams that are circulating. As the government's cost of living payments come to an end and the Household Support Fund is set to close at the end of March, there may be an even more urgent need for extra money in low-income households. But being directly contacted by people or organisations promising money should arouse instant suspicion. One councillor in the Black Country has urged people to be aware of text messages, emails or phone calls telling them to apply for cost of living assistance. City of Wolverhampton Council issued the alert in relation to its own Household Support Fund, saying that all the cash paid out by the scheme comes directly from the authority itself. In a warning on its website, the council said, "The Household Support Fund is not operated by any third parties on the council's behalf, so please don't fall prey to scams. If anyone contacts you directly offering money, this is not legitimate. The only way to apply for the fund is to contact the council direct, as outlined below." Wolverhampton was awarded almost £5.3 million in the latest round of Household Support Fund allocations from the DWP. A similar sum went to Dudley, £6.9 million to Sandwell and £5.6 million to Warsaw. What cost of living support can you get? Where a household needs assistance with food, the following amounts will be awarded by the City of Wolverhampton Council. Single adult £25, couple £50, addition for each child in the household £15. Where a household needs assistance with fuel, the following amounts will be awarded. Single adult £40, couple £60, addition for each child in the household £15. You can apply for funding at the Wolverhampton Household Support Fund webpage.
Now then, have you received an orange bin tag amid the new hardline recycling collection policy across Wolverhampton? As reported last week, thousands of bins have gone unemptied after residents were deemed to not be properly disposing of their rubbish, with the tags being placed on any recycling bins containing the incorrect items, asking residents to remove anything that shouldn't be in there. So, what can you put in your recycling bin if you live in Wolverhampton? Here's Ian with all the information on what you can put in your recycling bin to stop contamination.
Items that can be put in your recycling bin: aerosols, cardboard, for example, cereal boxes, delivery boxes, cardboard envelopes. Remove plastic inserts, polystyrene and packing tape. Drink cans, foil packaging, food tins, empty and rinse out. Glass bottles and jars, empty and rinse out. Household plastic bottles, remove any pumps, for example shampoo, washing up liquid, bleach. Newspapers, magazines and catalogues. Paper, for example computer paper, envelopes, flyers, leaflets. Paper bags, greetings cards without glitter, plastic drinks bottles, for example milk, squash, pop bottles, plastic packaging, empty, rinse out and remove any film or soft plastic lids or absorbent pads in the bottom, for example margarine tubs, yogurt pots, food trays, food and drink cartons, for example juice, soup, milk. So what can't you put in your recycling bin if you live in Wolverhampton? Here's Christine with all the information on what you can't put in your recycling bin.
Items that can't be put into your recycling bin: pizza boxes, as they are too contaminated by food residue. Polystyrene, e.g. food containers and packaging inserts. Nappies and sanitary products. Garden waste. Textiles, clothing or bedding, electrical items, glittery cards, wrapping paper, laminated paper, shiny metallic paper, sticky paper, e.g. sticky notes and sticky labels, tissues, ribbon and bows decorations, cling film, food waste, soft plastic wrappers, e.g. crisps and sweet packets, laminated pouches, e.g. pet food and coffee, medicine packs, e.g. plastic paracetamol packets, plastic bottles containing hazardous chemicals, e.g. antifreeze, toothpaste tubes, wet wipes, cotton wool or pads, plastic bags, needles or medical waste, hard plastics, e.g. toys and reusable water bottles, batteries, gas bottles, any other general waste, shredded paper or drinking glasses.
And a few extra bite-sized pieces of guidance from Wolverhampton Council. Please do not use bags. Cans should be crushed. Plastic bottles should be squashed with the lids screwed back on. And boxes should be flattened. Do not squash recycling into your bin, as this may get stuck and prevent it coming out of your bin when being emptied. If any of these items are in your bin will not be collected. Incorrect items in your black bin means waste cannot be recycled and has to be disposed of separately, costing money and losing environmental benefits. Put your bin on the curbside before 6:30 on your collection day.
Up next, we hear from Helen, who, as usual, has our latest Beacon update.
Hi everyone, it's Helen from the Beacon Centre here with your weekly update of everything that's been happening here at the charity. And I'm starting this week with some exciting news. Our first Garden Centre visit of the year is coming up on Tuesday, April 30th at Bridge North Garden Centre. Join us for some fun and exploration of all things green. To reserve your spot, call 01902 880111 or email inquiries@beaconvision.org. Now, can you give the greatest gift of all, your time? Well, join us for open days throughout March and discover the joy of volunteering with the Beacon Centre for the Blind. Whether you're passionate about making a difference or simply curious about how you can help, we welcome you to come along and learn more. Our first event takes place on the 8th of March in our Sedgley shop. Then we'll be holding one on the 14th of March in our Bilston shop. And finally, the 21st of March in our Wolverhampton Clearance Centre, all of which will run between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. To find out more, email people@beaconvision.org or call us on 01902 880111. Let's make a positive impact together. Now, tributes have been paid this week to a stalwart of the JW Hunt Cup and West Midlands football scene, who has sadly passed away at the age of 95. Walter Wakeman served as both secretary and treasurer to the Cup, which raises funds for Beacon. He was also a referee instructor, helping up to 500 people to become match officials. Isn't that wonderful? Now, you can read a full tribute on our website, www.beaconvision.org. Last this week, spring is in the air, although I'm not quite sure the weather thinks so yet. And, well, it's a perfect time for a fresh start. If you're planning a spring clean this March, why not give your pre-loved items a new home at the Beacon Centre for the Blind shops? Donate your good quality clothing, household goods and more to support our cause. Every donation helps us empower people with sight loss to live a fuller, more independent life. You can drop off your donations at any of our shops during opening hours. Visit our website for more information about donating and find out where your nearest shop is. The website, just in case you need it again, is www.beaconvision.org. That's it for this week. I'll be back again soon with another update. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot for that update, Helen. Up next, we have another block of local news.
Car cruising and street racing in the Black Country have been banned after the High Court issued a full and final injunction. The ruling prohibits people from participating as a driver, a rider, or a passenger in a gathering of two or more people where those present engage in motor racing, stunts, or other dangerous or obstructive driving. The application for the injunction was led by the City of Wolverhampton Council on behalf of Dudley Council, Sandwell Council, and Walsall Council, and supported by West Midlands Police. It covers the whole of the four Black Country boroughs. The final ruling follows a review of an interim injunction earlier this month. PC Mark Campbell from the Operation Hercules team, West Midlands Police's tactical response to street racing in the West Midlands, described the injunction as highly valuable and a tried and tested means of prevention and resolution. He said it is only a matter of time before the high-speed driving involved in organised races leads to another multiple fatality incident. This may be the driver of the vehicle, an innocent member of the public, or any number of spectators actively taking part in the street cruising meet. He added he had witnessed 400 plus vehicles at street cruises in locations like the Black Country Route in Bilston or Manor Way, Hales Owen, and that the potential for a very serious collision is because of the speeds involved. Pardip Nagra from Wolverhampton's anti-social behaviour team, who presented evidence, including statements from councillors, MPs, residents and businesses across the Black Country, told the court, "I believe it is vital we have an injunction in place across the Black Country to enable West Midlands Police and the four councils to continue to tackle the dangerous and anti-social activity of car cruising. There is overwhelming support from local residents and businesses who, prior to the previous injunction being in place, had all suffered for many years and who are concerned that without an injunction, the scale of the car cruising issue will return to the levels experienced previously." Speaking after the ruling, Councillor Jasbir Jaspal, the City of Wolverhampton Council's Cabinet Member for Adults and Wellbeing, said, "We are delighted that the High Court has seen fit to grant this full and final injunction, which will help us continue to tackle the menace of street racing in the Black Country. The wealth of evidence presented to the court makes it clear the impact this antisocial, irresponsible, and highly dangerous behaviour has had on people across our region, and the tragic incidents both locally and nationally which have caused serious injuries and even fatalities.
A Wolverhampton firm is giving drivers the chance to win a free tank of fuel up to the value of £100. AMV Couriers Limited, based at Maryhills Enterprise Park, has so far had 62 winners of its free giveaway. Free Fuel Friday is open to all residents with a WV, WS, TF, B, ST or SY postcode, and people can enter via Facebook and Instagram. The draw is made every Friday afternoon with the chance to win for the following week starting each Saturday. People can simply comment on the post each week to be in with a chance of winning. For the next 4 weeks, there will be a chance for a charity to win also. The person commenting just needs to nominate their favourite local charity in the comments. If they're the lucky winner, they will both win a tank of fuel worth up to £100 each. Enter by visiting facebook.com/FreeFuelFridays or Instagram.com/FreeFuelFridays.
From gallons and litres to something a little more pint-sized. As thieves had a lot of bottle after a Black Country dairy had their irreplaceable milk float stolen. It won't be a case of the fastest milk cart in the Black Country, more like three wheels on my wagon, after a King's Wynford dairy suffered the theft of one of its electric floats. Rigstock Dairies in Stallings Lane have a fleet of 20 floats with a top speed of 25 miles per hour and a range of 40 miles. Dating back to 1972, which cover a wide area on daily milk rounds. One of them suffered a punctured tyre while on the way to a delivery off the A449 in the Wombourne area at 2:30 a.m. last Tuesday morning. Staff were sent out from the depot to recover the vehicle, but it was found the tyre couldn't be fixed, and it was left until 10 a.m. for when a garage in King's Wynford was open and they went to try and find it, but found it had gone. Police say it was taken from Battlefield Hill at around 10 a.m. Two men were seen loading it onto a dark blue transit truck, where the onlookers thought it was being taken away to be repaired. Malcolm Brigstock is the managing director of the dairy. At the age of 80, he still does regular office shifts, and his son Andy also works there. Malcolm told the Express and Star that the vehicles can be worth up to £30,000 to recondition, and the whole vehicle can't be replaced as they are not manufactured anymore. Andy said, "We run around 17 of them, and three are spares, but they are like Trigger's broom in terms of they have had so many different parts over the years. They are not actually the original vehicles, but they are amazingly sturdy, and the batteries are worth quite a lot of money and use the same technology as Tesla cars, which may surprise people. In all the years I have been working here, we have never had one stolen, and it must have taken quite an effort as there were only three working wheels due to the tyre blowout, and each vehicle is 3 tons in weight. I don't know why it was taken. I can only speculate they might want to break it down and sell the parts or the battery, but at least we have replacements. It is more the inconvenience and the loss of the vehicle as well, because we pride ourselves on operating the electric floats in the traditional way. They are reliable and people love to see them on the streets." A spokesperson for Staffordshire Police said, "If you saw what happened, or if you have any CCTV, dashcam or doorbell footage that could help our inquiries, please get in touch. You can call us on 101, quoting incident 348, or call us using live chat on our website. You can also call Crime Stoppers anonymously on 0800 555 111.
Now it's time to test your knowledge. as we have the quiz questions for this edition brought to us by Mina.
Hello and welcome to this week's flashback quiz. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers' Did You Know feature. But for now, these are your questions. Here we go. Question 1. How old is the oldest wooden wheel? Question 2. What seems to happen to our ears as we grow older? Question 3. What is the common name for an octothorpe? Question 4. What is house dust mostly made up of? Question 5. Which nostril do dogs use to sniff out food and the like? And finally, question 6. Which country has more pyramids than Egypt? I will be back later in the show to give you all your answers, but for now, best of luck!
Thanks for those, Mina. I'll get my mind working on them right now. Up next, however, let's have another block of local news.
A scarce Harry Potter first edition given to an RSPCA charity shop has raised thousands of pounds for the animal charity. The book, given by a mystery donor to the RSPCA, sold for a hammer price of £7,500 at Hanson's auctioneer Bishton Hall Auction in Staffordshire. All funds raised will directly go towards helping animals in the charity's care, now and in the future. Rebecca Busby, fundraising, marketing and engagement officer at the RSPCA, said, "The book was gifted to one of our charity shops as a possible first edition. One of our volunteers, who is an avid Harry Potter fan and book enthusiast, checked for all the well-known markers and noticed it had them all. She called me and I could hear her excitement as she said, 'I can't believe it. We have a Harry Potter first edition. It's in the best condition I've ever seen. Please could you find somewhere to sell this, as we can't sell it in the shop.' One of the dogs set to benefit is another Harry, an 11-month-old cockapoo type who found himself in the care of the branch following his owner's change in circumstances, which meant they were unable to look after him. Rebecca said, 'I'm sure Harry Potter will help his namesake, Harry the dog, find his magical home and enjoy an amazing new chapter in his life.' When the book was discovered, the RSPCA team called in Jim Spencer, a world-renowned Potter books expert based at Hanson's Auctioneer Staffordshire Sale Room, Bishton Hall. Jim said, "It would have been very difficult to find another copy as well preserved as this one. It deserved to set tails wagging at auction. I'm delighted it's raised thousands for such a great cause." As well as securing a strong investment, the buyer can be doubly happy in the knowledge money raised will help animals like Harry. This book represents the beginning of the Harry Potter phenomenon. Not many paperbacks published in the 1990s have the potential to fetch thousands of pounds at auction. Nobody predicted the huge popularity of Harry Potter, so these books were printed on cheap paper stock, This, coupled with the fact it's a children's book, means most examples are in very poor condition, showing signs of being swung about in a school rucksack, full of doodles, stained from orange squash, or, at the very least, faded at the spine from sunlight hitting the bookcase. This one is exceptional. The only minor flaws are a couple of lightly folded corners and the usual light browning to page edges, which is in fact a reassuring sign due to the cheap paper that was used. I'd be worried if the pages didn't have this slight discoloration. Rebecca said, "We are confident this donation will help us rehome many more animals in the charity's care, as the RSPCA celebrates its 200th birthday this year."
From something scarce to something rather unique that perhaps Professor Dumbledore or Lord Voldemort could help with, as the search is on for anyone who can make sense of an incredibly rare book for sale in Wolverhampton, a 1752 tome about diseases written in Latin. The 272-year-old leather-bound book is for sale at the pop-up bookshop in the Mander Centre, and is the subject of morbid fascination. Observations de Air a Morbis Epidemicis by Joanne Huxham is on sale for just £50 due to the subject matter and being written in Latin. Bookseller Judith Goodman described the book about epidemic diseases as incredibly rare but also incredibly difficult to sell. However, when first printed, the book was seen as cutting-edge science and medical thought, and sold throughout Europe, helped by its Latin prose. Judith told the Express and Star, "The book is very rare and is the oldest book I have in the pop-up bookshop. I bought it from a friend of mine who had a great collection but sadly was diagnosed with dementia. The book was originally owned by the University of Glasgow and still has its stamp on the inside cover." Though Joanne Huxham might sound like the name of a female author, the book was actually written by John Huxham. Huxham, who lived between 1692 and 1768, made daily records of the weather and prevailing diseases and wanted to prove the relationship between atmosphere and disease. The Devon physician and doctor studied fevers and in 1755 received the Copley Medal for his contribution to medicine. His 1752 Latin book was based on his previous publication, Essay on Fevers. His Latin version, published in London, graced the great libraries and universities of France, Spain, the Holy Roman Empire and beyond. He was said to be the first Briton to coin the word influenza, and was made a Fellow of the Royal Society. The pop-up bookshop includes a selection of old books, including an illustrated 1850s medical book of brains and heads, among the 5,000 books for sale at any one time. Judith, from near Wenlock Edge in Shropshire, has sold books throughout the Midlands for decades, pitching up in the region's towns for short spells. However, after penning a deal with the Mander Centre, she is in the middle of a three-month residency in Wolverhampton. She said, "The people of Wolverhampton really are bookworms. They like the classics like Jane Austen, but they are also railway mad. Every day I get someone asking me about one railway book or another." Judith's favourite book is Black Beauty. She has over 70 copies of the equine classic, but like every other book dealer, she is on the lookout for that rarest of finds, a first edition of a classic or a recalled title which remained on the market. Another book which is like the Holy Grail for booksellers is an edition of Rupert the Bear with a brown face, not his usual white fur. Judith said, "It was published in the early 1970s and recalled. I always try and snap up Rupert the Bear on the off chance it could be the rarest of rare books." Now then, grab yourself a cuppa, find your comfy spot, as it's time for another riveting book review. This week, Sound News contributor Rob Pearman talks to Val Page about the audio version of the best-selling novel The 100-Year-Old Man Who Climbed Out of the Window and Disappeared.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
The book we're going to talk about today has got a long title, and it's a curious title. It's called The 100-Year-Old Man Who Climbed Out of the Window and Disappeared. And it's described as an international best-selling sensation because it's written by a Swedish author and then translated. Yes. Jonas Jonasson. Val, give us a clue. What is this 100-year-old man? Where is he? Where does he start off?
Well, he starts off in an old folks' home. I find the whole book actually very liberating. It's a sort of a joyous romp. This old man is 100 years old, and they're going to make a big thing of his 100th birthday. They've got the mayor coming, they've got the press coming, all the staff are going to be there, and he just doesn't want it. So it's not really this celebration about him and his 100th birthday. It's really a sort of bit of advertisement for the home and so on. And he's supposed to be getting ready. And director Alice, who is a very angry sort of director who looks after the home, is nagging him to get ready and come out. And he climbs out of the window and goes for a little walk.
You might think he could have made up his mind earlier and been man enough to tell the others of his decision, but Allan Carlson had never been given to ponder things too long. So the idea had barely taken hold in the old man's head before he opened the window of his room on the ground floor of the old people's home in the town of Malmchirping and stepped out into the flower bed.
Now, it might seem unusual for a 100-year-old man to climb out of the window. And this is what I find is so liberating. He's living in a home where everything's ordered and the food is brought to him, and he has to get dressed when he's told to get dressed, and the food comes when it comes, and he has no say in it. But suddenly, life opens up for him, and he climbs out of the window and goes for a walk. He's only got his slippers on, and he doesn't mind. And one thinks, how can this possibly happen? And as the story unfolds, one realises that his previous life has been a very, very unusual one. And so the book alternates between talking about his previous life and all the exciting adventures that he's had, unbelievable adventures, some people would say, I think most people would say, and really he's running away now because he's running away both from the home, Director Alice has set the police on him, and he's running away from a gang of evil people.
Now, he encounters those gangs more or less by accident. I mean, the evil people are not ones he's gone looking for, but almost everything about his life is an accident. And we can come perhaps to his past life a bit later, but he sets off and he's got to get away from where he is. So, of course, he goes to the bus station.
Yes.
And the bus station leads him into an encounter with a character. That character turns out to be one of the evil ones. And the main character, his name is Allan, isn't it? Allan
Carlson.
He seems to get away with all sorts of things. Everything works for him.
Yes. Or not everything, because he has long spells in prisons, various prisons.
Oh, during his lifetime, yes.
Oh, during his lifetime, yes.
But as he proceeds, he encounters all sorts of these very strange, very bizarre people. All of whom have got a history of their own.
Oh, yes. Very interesting histories as well. In fact, at the bus station where he's waiting for a bus to take him anywhere, he doesn't mind where, a young man is desperate for the toilet and has a huge heavy suitcase, and he asks this innocent-looking old man to look after his suitcase while he goes to the loo. While he goes, the bus comes, so the old man thinks he better not leave the suitcase there, and the kindly bus conductor helps him onto the bus and puts the case in the boot of the bus. And whereupon Allan Carlson has got, well, he's got a fair bit of money in his pocket, but he decides to spend 50 crowns and says, how far will 50 crowns take me? And gets off at the stop, which is an old disused railway station in the middle of the country, together with this suitcase. So in a sense, he has stolen the new suitcase, although he had no intention of doing so originally. He thought he was helping the young man. I have to say, this book isn't everybody's cup of tea. When we first read it in our reading group, we all loved it. It's a humorous book. There's a lot of humour in it. And one of the group said, absolute rubbish. I was talking to her recently and I found out she'd only read the first 50 pages and she hadn't really followed it through. As this old man goes on and we get a glimpse of his past life, it's clear that he has had a very, very exciting life and has been present at most of the world events in the last century. On this occasion, he meets a very interesting man who's living in the station, and his background was that he had arranged, this is Jonas Jonasson, and he had arranged to put electricity into the centre, and he'd made a lot of money in the whole area. And he'd made a lot of money doing this, and unfortunately, when he ordered the telegraph poles to put all the electricity on, he had ordered them all a little bit too short. All the farmers in the area had bought new combine harvesters. So when electricity came to the area and they started using their combine harvesters, all the electricity lines were mowed down by the combine harvesters and the electricity in the whole area was out for a week and nothing worked. And he'd had to run away and hide. So he was quite a character to begin with. And Alan and he open the case together and they find inside 50 million crowns. Well, that's quite a lot of money and they decide that they would run away with it together. And they get as far as a chap who runs a hot dog stall. Now, this man is another interesting man. His name is Benny. And his background is that he and his brother inherited a lot of money and the limitations on having the money were that they had to study. And so his brother enrolled them both in a short course, which apparently qualified, and they would only get paid while they were studying a monthly allowance, quite a good monthly allowance. But his brother was very bossy, and Benny, just to pay him out, he enrolled in a much longer course, a degree course. Just before the end, he dropped out. And apparently, under the terms of this will, you were allowed to do that as long as you took up further study. So in his lifetime, he had done many degrees, nearly degrees. So he was nearly a vet. He was nearly a doctor. He was nearly a chemical engineer. So that was his background. He had a car and he and Jonas set off in the car with the money. And that's how their main journey started.
After a while, Julia started to rustle with something in the back seat. He held out an opened bag of sweets to Alan and Benny. "Just look what I found in my pocket," he said. Alan raised his eyebrows. "You stole a bag of sweets when we've got 50 million in the suitcase?" "You've got 50 million in the suitcase?" asked Benny. "Oops," said Alan.
"Not quite," said Julius. "We gave you 100,000.
"Plus 500 for the petrol," said Alan. Benny was silent for a few seconds.
"So you've got 49,899,500 crowns in the suitcase?"
"You have a head for numbers," said Alan.
And that's the adventure that goes on from the moment he steps out through the window and,
yes,
and disappears. He yes. then gets in with these strange people and they've all got these great back histories, which are amusing and the whole thing is very funny. Because he alternates, once he gets going, he then goes back into his past as well. He starts to, the author starts to tell us a lot about his past. And he was something of an explosives freak. He liked blowing things up. He'd got that from his father. And he ends up in the 1930s involved in the Spanish Civil War. So it's a long story to get there. But there he is in Spain in the Spanish Civil War. And he sets some explosives to blow up a bridge.
Yes.
And some characters are coming across that. A little swaggering man with military uniforms. And he stands up and shouts at them because he's worried they're going to be blown up by this.
Because he said his job was to blow up bridges, not to blow up people. So he shouted at them to get back, you know, you're going to...
Yes. And in fact, they run forward thinking they'll capture him. And then the bridge blows up.
And when the smoke settled, there was no longer any question of killing Alan. The little man with the medals shook his hand and explained that a real general knows how to show his appreciation and that the best thing now was for the group to withdraw to the other side again, with or without a bridge. If his saviour wanted to come along, he was more than welcome. Once there, the general would invite him to dinner. "Paella Andaluz," said the general. "My cook is from the south. Comprende?"
General Franco, as this man
is
turns out,
swaggering.
He is the little swaggering military man, who then becomes a firm friend of our hero, because, of course, he thinks the hero saved his life.
Yes.
And that is the sort of context within which we dip backwards all the time into different periods of history. And, of course, the Spanish Civil War is followed by the main World War and the rise of communism. So who else does he encounter? Remind me.
Well, when he leaves Spain, having, you know, risen to quite a high position with as Franco's assistant, he takes a boat to anywhere. And then that's sort of typical. He emphasizes all the way through this that he's not political. And yet he becomes accidentally involved in all the major political events of the world. So he takes a boat to anywhere, and it turns out he goes to America.
Yeah.
And he's put into prison there because he's an alien and so on. And then they find out that he's very good on explosives. And he is sort of drawn into working for them on explosives. And he is serving the coffee, I think it is, to a group of people who are trying to work out how to split the atom. And he makes a suggestion that the two critical masses could be separated and then put together and detonated. And so he is the hero of the day, and he gets to meet President Truman and becomes a good friend of President Truman.
Because effectively he was responsible for the splitting the atom and the rise of the nuclear power, as it were.
Yes.
And then later he gets, I can't remember which comes in which sequence, but certainly I remember he was in Russia. Probably that was connected with the Americans. He got to know Stalin.
Yes. At that time, before that, he was in a Russian prison for some time. And that's where he learned to speak Russian. And of course, when he was in the American prison, that was when he learned to speak English. And in Spain, with his Spanish friend, he learned to speak Spanish. He was really quite a bright bloke.
And all of these are told almost tongue-in-cheek. But it's very amusing. I found it very amusing. It's not the most profound book that either of us have ever read, but actually it's sort of reflecting the last century as well, isn't it? It covers all the key historical points. He goes to China, goes to North Korea, and he meets, well, you know, the North Korean dictators and Mao Zedong and Mao Zedong's wife, and gets involved with them, and he becomes a friend of everybody.
Yes, of course his two main assets are that he's an explosive expert, that he knows a lot of very important people, and he can speak various languages.
And meanwhile, his day job, as it were, the continuation of his actual life, he's now 100 and rising, he carries on with these strange gang that keep adding different people. The police are trying to find him, and the characters of the police are developed as well. And there's an elephant, there's just too many things coming in to describe them all. But the mood continues, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. And I think, you know, some of the little bits of humour that I've picked out is, you know, there was a motorcycle gang that was after him, and they fancied themselves not the brightest motorcycle gang in the world, and they thought that they would call themselves the Violents, but they weren't very good at spelling. And one of the gang's girlfriends made them jackets, and they asked her to embroider the Violents on the backs of their jackets, but she wasn't good at spelling, and she embroidered the Violins. So this fierce motorcycle gang were known as the Violins, which I thought was funny. And then one of them was in prison, and he thought he'd start his own gang, and he'd call himself Boss, and his two henchmen were Bucket and Bolt. Bolt was actually the young man with a suitcase full of 50 million crowns, which were really criminal.
Yeah, I mean, they've been stolen from somewhere else.
Oh, they've been stolen from somewhere else, you see. So. Yeah. And he actually died quite early on, quite accidentally. Bucket actually slipped in the elephant poo, and the elephant sat on him. So he accidentally got killed as well. So it's that sort of throwaway humour all the way through. Alan met a really nice lady towards the end who was quite young for him because she was only 85, and she wasn't very bright. And Alan ended with some encouraging words about how he thought there wasn't a single person in the world who had gone so far with such a limited intelligence as Amanda had done. And Amanda thought that was so beautifully said that tears came to her eyes. It's a sort of throwaway humour like that all the way through.
And it's great fun to listen to, and it's really just a good, humorous listen,
it is.
Isn't it?
It is.
Thank you very much, Val.
TNS Soundings.
Now then, This week marks 40 years since the miners' strike that shook the nation like no other industrial unrest. With thanks to Mark Andrews of The Express and Star, the Black Country Talking News brings a major new series looking back at the dispute and our region's part in it. Miners' Strike 40 Years On, Episode 1. Battle in Brum sowed the seeds of what was to come.
Four decades on, the year-long miners' strike still touches a raw nerve with Alan Pearson. When asked for his memories about the dispute, he is suspicious about how he will be reported and guarded in his answers. "I was on strike all the way through," says the now chairman of Cannock Chase Council, who was then a 30-year-old miner at Littleton Colliery. "There was no bullying, no intimidation from our side. The only intimidation we ever saw came from the police," he adds curtly. It will be 40 years this month since the outbreak of the 1984-85 miners' strike. And with the possible exception of the general strike of 1926, it is hard to think of an industrial dispute, at least within living memory, which stirs up more emotion. While today's disputes involving doctors and rail workers may be frustrating, there is nothing like the kind of rancour which occurred 40 years ago. Families were divided, friendships broken. Close-knit communities were split asunder, and in some instances, the acrimony turned violent. Three people paid with their lives, 200 spent time in prison, and 20,000 suffered injuries as the tensions mounted. And for those miners who stuck it out to the bitter end, it was a period of great hardship. There would have been little common ground between Councillor Pearson and Michael Eaton, who at the time was chief spokesman for the National Coal Board. But surely even he would have agreed with Mr. Eaton when he said, "There is no victory. The coal industry has lost, it's the victim. We have lost markets, we have lost good labour relations over the course of this dispute."
The strike began in South Yorkshire on March 5, 1984, spreading across the country over the days that followed. But in reality, the tensions had been building up for more than a decade, and the seed for the ongoing strike in 1984 was sown in the West Midlands. Some believed that a confrontation was inevitable from the moment that firebrand Arthur Scargill was elected as leader of the National Union of Mine Workers in 1982. Others felt that Margaret Thatcher had been looking for a reason to clip the miners' wings, having seen her predecessor Ted Heath brought down by a strike 10 years earlier that saw Mr. Scargill emerge as a leader of workers at a coke storage plant in Birmingham. There is probably an element of truth in both these arguments, and the old saying about the irresistible force coming into contact with the immovable object proved to be the case. The only matter up for debate is which of the main protagonists was the irresistible force and which was the immovable object. When NUM leader Joe Gormley called his men out on strike in January 1972, the general consensus was that the action would almost certainly fail. Woodrow Wyatt, the former Labour MP for Aston turned journalist, wrote in the Daily Mirror, "Rarely have strikers advanced to the barricades with less enthusiasm or hope of success. The miners have more stacked against them than the Light Brigade in their famous charge." In the union's first official national strike since 1926, the miners were demanding pay rises of 35 to 47%, while the National Coal Board, NCB, offered 7.4%. It was reported that sufficient stockpiles of coal had been amassed to meet the nation's needs for 8 weeks, but it quickly became apparent that these supplies were unevenly distributed around the country. By the start of February, the Central Electricity Generating Board warned that the last large accessible stockpile of solid fuel in the country was held by West Midlands Gas Board at its gasworks in Neachells, Birmingham. Prior to the strike, Gasworks, which made gas out of coal, made a small income from selling coke, a byproduct of the process, to local schools and hospitals. But as the shortages began to bite, the two or three lorries a day which had been collecting coke from the depot grew to about 700. As news emerged about the mile-long queues outside the depot, a small group of miners from the Cannock Chase coalfield began picketing at the depot, but had little impact in stopping the lorries from getting through.
And then Arthur Scargill entered the fray. Until that time, the 34-year-old leader of the Yorkshire Union branch was little known outside his area. But his role in the Battle of Saltley Gate, it took its name from a nearby toll house, brought him firmly into the national spotlight. Having watched the failure of the local pickets to prevent the delivery of fuel supplies, Scargill pioneered the use of what would become known as flying pickets. He led a delegation of 400 miners from Yorkshire down to Birmingham, but even then he struggled to stop the supplies from getting out. So he appealed to workers in neighbouring factories to join the miners in solidarity, and about 30,000 turned out to support them. "A roar went up," Scargill recalled. "I looked round, and coming over the hill as far as the eye could see were thousands of engineers to join us, and women leading them. Hopelessly outnumbered, the police and the delivery drivers had little choice but to call it a day. The gate of the gasworks were closed, and the chief constable of Birmingham City Police handed Scargill a loud hailer, asking him to get the crowds to disperse. I got on top of a urinal, and I spoke to the crowd, and there was a feeling like I've never seen in my life," he said. "There were miners with tears in their eyes, tears of pride. Faced with the prospect of a national power shortage, Heath's government threw in the towel and agreed to the union's pay demand. We'd won, and it was the turning point in the miners' strike," said Scargill. "It led to a complete victory. It was the greatest day of my life. The young firebrand from Barnsley was now firmly entrenched as one of the big hitters on the political stage. Scargill's victory in the Battle of Saltley Gate marked the beginning of the end of Heath's tenure as Prime Minister." Emboldened by their success, the miners went on strike again in 1974, resulting in the three-day week, and Heath calling a snap general election on the issue of who runs Britain, me or the miners. While Heath won the popular vote, he finished four seats behind Labour. His failure to negotiate a deal with the Liberals resulted in Harold Wilson returning to Downing Street. Wilson immediately met the miners' demands, while Heath was ousted as Conservative leader by Margaret Thatcher, and Scargill was now firmly established as the rising star of the union movement. Bringing the unions to heel was already firmly on the agenda by the time Thatcher was elected Prime Minister in 1979. Wilson's shock resignation in 1976 saw him replaced with the avuncular Jim Callaghan, whose time in office was brought to an abrupt end by the 1979 winter of discontent. With two prime ministers, one Tory, one Labour, having been brought down by industrial anarchy, the new incumbent knew she would likely face a similar fate if she was unable to tame the union beast, and she had the advantage of 5 years' preparation when Scargill came knocking in 1984.
Up next, it's trivia time, brought to us by Flashback Roger and his Did You Know feature. Take it away, Roger.
Hello again, everyone. I couldn't think of a particular theme for this week, so I've dug up a mixed bag of facts for you to mull over. So here goes. Now then, did you know that? The world's oldest wooden wheel has been around for more than 5,000 years. It was found in 2002, approximately 12 miles south of Ljubljana, the capital of Slovenia. Radiocarbon dating was used to determine the wheel's age, which is somewhere between 5,100 and 5,350 years old. And it's pretty common to see the claim that our nose and ears are the only parts of our body that keeps growing as we age, but that's not exactly true. Our nose and ears stop growing along with the rest of our body, but thanks to the weight of gravity, both parts continue to lengthen over time. And that odd-shaped, eight-ended symbol commonly referred to as the hashtag is officially called the Octothorpe. But that's never going to catch on by Twitter in giving an address, is it? The octo means eight and refers to its points, though reports disagree on what the Thorpe stands for. Here's a pleasant one. Dead skin cells are the main ingredient in household dust. There's an interesting science fact for you. Because according to researchers at Imperial College London, humans shed about 200 million skin cells an hour, and they do have to go somewhere when they're indoors, don't they? If the idea of skin dust isn't sitting well with you, you should know that a report from the American Chemical Society found that a skin oil called squalene naturally helps reduce indoor ozone by up to 15%. And dogs sniff good smells with their left nostril. Dogs normally start sniffing with their right nostril, then keep it there if the smell could signal danger. But they'll shift to the left side for something pleasant like food or a mating partner. And Sudan has more pyramids than any country in the world. Not only does Sudan have more pyramids than Egypt, but the numbers aren't even close. While 138 pyramids have been discovered in Egypt, Sudan boasts around 255. Well then, few things there to ponder over for sure, and there are some facts in there to remember when you go to a quiz somewhere. Any road up, I'm off. It's past me snack time, so it's kettle on for a brew, and for me to raid the biscuit tin again. Till next week then, I'll say bye for now. Ta-ra, Ribbit. Ta-ra.
Up now we have to hear what the weather has in store for us. Brought to us, come rain or shine, by our own Sunny Mina.
The weather for this week ahead is forecast to remain unsettled, with plenty of showers and with light winds coming in from the east. Temperatures should remain average for this time of year. UV levels are expected to remain low. The sunrise and sunset times are 6:25 a.m. for the sunrise and 6:10 p.m. for the sunset. Friday, 8th of March is forecast to give us the best chance of staying dry, with sunny intervals breaking through throughout the day. With a moderate breeze, temperatures are forecast to be around 10 degrees. Moving on, an unsettled, wet spell of weather looks set to return as we head into the weekend. With the winds continuing to drive in from the east, a breeze weekend also means temperatures should remain mild at 11 degrees, although this may feel more like 7 degrees. On to next week, where the spell of wet weather will continue to dominate once again, with plenty of light rain and drizzle hanging around. It is forecast for rain to remain in the region on Monday, 11th of March, and continue right through to Thursday, 14th of March. With light winds coming in from the southeast, temperatures may well remain in double digits as we head into the middle part of the week, with highs of 12 degrees. So, there you have it. Another big bag full of showers. As always, do take care and enjoy the weather.
Cheers for that weather update, Mina. Now it's time to find out how our local football teams have been getting on.
Albion held off a late Coventry fight back for three important points in the race for a championship top six spot as the Shillin-Patel era got up and running in victorious style. The hawthorn sounded in the mood early on, ramped up by the return of the liquidator, and the home fans only had to wait 6 minutes for the opener from their side, and a fine one at that. Not a lot looked on when the ball found Johnston on the left touchline. But before right wing-back Milan von Ewijk knew it, he had been nutmegged and Johnston tore into the box. He sent Josh Eccles the wrong way before a belting right-footed finish into the far corner. It was a third goal in 5 games for the on-loan Celtic ace and another picture-book finish like at Plymouth not so long ago. Fittingly, barely 60 seconds after the restart, all 4 sides of the Hawthorns rose in appreciation and support for Tony Mowbray, former Baggies and Sky Blues boss and Birmingham chief who is battling illness. Mowbray is loved and respected by both clubs, and that shone through in the moment. Carlos Corberan's hosts opened up a 2-0 halftime lead through a lovely team goal finished by Grady Diangana 10 minutes before the break, and it all looked plain sailing for the hosts until Sky Blues substitute Hadji Wright halved the deficit with a penalty 18 minutes from time to set up an edgy finale on the week the US investor and entrepreneur completed his takeover from Guachuan Lai. Despite stoppage time jitters, Albion held on with relative ease for what felt like a key win, which leaves the Black Country outfit in 5th place and 4 points clear of Norwich in 7th. Speaking after the game, Corberan focused on toasting a return to winning ways at home after a defeat to Southampton 2 weeks ago, describing the win as an important result. The Baggies now head on their travels for another 2 away fixtures this week at QPR and Huddersfield respectively, and will look to build on their current momentum. And from promotion push jitters to tatters up top for Wolves, as it was confirmed Wolves have suffered another injury nightmare, with Hwang Hee-chan ruled out for around 6 weeks, joining fellow attacker Mateus Cunha on the treatment table. With Gary O'Neill making 4 changes from the midweek FA Cup win over Brighton and playing without any recognised striker, Wolves suffered their first away loss for more than 2 months as their hopes of cracking Europe took a knock with a 3-0 defeat to Newcastle. As the rain hammered down in the northeast, Wolves made a decent start to the game, with some surging runs from Neto causing panic in the Newcastle back line. The hosts offered a threat in behind, and on the quarter hour mark, Wolves' fairly good start to the game was undone after they were caught out by a swift counter-attack, when a shot from Newcastle's Brazilian midfielder Bruno deflected fortuitously off Craig Dawson and looped into the path of Isak for an easy close-range header. O'Neill's side were struggling for a foothold in the game and conceded another avoidable goal that saw them go 2-0 down after 33 minutes. A first-time cross into the box saw Max Kilman leave it for Saar, but the pair got in each other's way and allowed the ball to squirm free for Anthony Gordon to tap in. Wolves wilted and entered half-time losing 2-0. As the teams came out for the second half, there was yet more injury concern and precaution for Wolves, as Gary O'Neill replaced Saar and Neto with Bentley and Nathan Fraser. A better second half display saw a nice Wolves counter-attack result in Fraser having a low shot saved as they looked for a way back into the game. Moments later, Sarabia went close at the near post. But eventually, the hosts found a late third when Livramento went beyond Dawson, shrugged off a challenge from Ryan Aynouri, and fell over before poking the ball beyond Bentley. It was another poor goal to concede and summed up a bad day at the office for Wolves, who are 10th in the Premier League and now 4 points off 7th place.
Now, here come the quiz
answers,
and they're brought to us by Mina.
Hello, and here are your answers for this week's flashback quiz. Feeling confident? How will you score? Let's see. Question 1. How old is the oldest wooden wheel? And the answer? 5,000 years. Question 2. What seems to happen to our ears as we grow older? And the answer here is, they appear to grow. Question 3. What is the common name for an octothorpe? And the answer here is, it's the hashtag. Question 4. What is house dust mostly made up of? And the answer, it's made up of dead skin cells. Question 5. Which nostril do dogs use to sniff out food and the like? And the answer, it's the left one. And finally, question 6. Which country has more pyramids than Egypt? It's Sudan. Did you get them all right? If not, not to worry, as I will be back next week to test you all again. Bye for now.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!